From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. What a night in store for you tonight. Open lines, time traveling, just about everything. Later tonight, we take some of you, not all of you, to the 22nd century with internationally known talk show host Dexter Monterey, who happens to be the reincarnated me. Stand by for that one. And also, we'll be talking about Noah's Ark for a while. But first, Douglas Hagman reports to us that earlier today, the FBI apparently issued an advisory to stadium operators to be on heightened alert for possible suicide bomb attacks during sporting events. A posting on a terrorist-sponsored website solicited homicide and suicide attacks against people at stadiums and sporting events in the United States using groups of 3 to 5. I have no idea why they would solicit this on a website. The posting advised potential bombers to hide homemade explosives under their winter clothing to avoid detection by stadium security. Also, the posting suggests that one terrorist operative should detonate an explosive outside the stadium while a second person is located near an exit as people are trying to escape. Again, this is a baffling story. Why they put it on a website, I do not know, so I have some, I'm suspect about it. A computer controlled by the power of thought alone has been unveiled at a major trade fair in Germany. It could provide a way for paralyzed patients to operate computers or for amputees to operate electronically controlled artificial limbs. But it also has non-medical applications, they say, such as in the computer games and entertainment industries, according to New Scientist magazine. If you own a General Motors truck, at least one of these, be on guard. General Motors is recalling about 900,000 pickup trucks worldwide to fix problems with tailgate cables that can corrode and break when loads are placed on them. The recall involves 1999 to 2000 models of the Chevrolet Silverado and GMC Sierra trucks. General Motors said that there have been 84 injuries so far, most of them minor scrapes and bumps. They say no crashes or deaths linked to the problem. North Carolina health officials are investigating the death of a woman who died last week of a flesh-eating bacteria 3 days after accidentally jamming her hand in a wheelchair while working at a nursing home. A nursing assistant, Sharon Bishop, 44 years old, died just a few weeks ago. A doctor said a rare flesh-eating bacteria may have entered her body through a thumb injury and turned her from healthy to fatally ill. The culprit, they say, could have been a rare invasive form of a group of streptococcal bacteria. Well, earlier this week, we had guest Philip Gardner on the program. He was talking about snakes. Well, scientists have discovered that venom from a deadly snake could soon save thousands of lives. The Taipan poison contains a miracle protein that clots blood instantly. The protein is called Factor X, could be used to stop bleeding during open heart surgery and operations on crash victims. The Taipan is a native to northern Australia. The Nigerian government, anxious to avoid a repeat of riots that marked a solar eclipse in 2001, has warned citizens they may suffer psychological discomfort during a new eclipse this month, but urged them not to panic. The information minister said an eclipse 5 years ago caused riots in northern Borno state because people did not know why it happened. Some people, they said, even felt that evil people in their communities were responsible for the eclipse. So he's trying to warn them all ahead of time. A NASA spacecraft successfully slipped into orbit around Mars, joining a trio of orbiters already circling the red planet. Scientists cheered after the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter emerged from the planet's shadow and signaled to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory that the maneuver was a success. Coast to Coast Science Advisor and the head of the EnterpriseMission.com website, Richard C. Hoagland, has been monitoring this event all day and is with us with a report. Richard, another success, finally, on this one, huh?
We now have 3 Happy spacecraft in orbit, U.S. spacecraft, and 2 rovers on the surface, so we basically are invading Mars.
We are. We've done a reversal here. Earth invades. Now, what's the significance of the MRO?
Okay, this is the most sophisticated spacecraft ever sent to another planet. Apart, of course, from manned missions to the moon. This thing carries a 20-inch telescope, George, which will be able to photograph objects from the nominal orbit, which is 180 miles up when they finally get it into the proper positioning. it'll be able to photograph things that will give us resolution of 12 inches per pixel. That means it'll be able to resolve my book on the surface of Mars if it was lying on Mars with the cover looking up.
What's so exciting about this is finally we've gotten a wave of successful Mars missions, Richard, after really some disappointing ones.
Well, this is only the first step. There is a very harrowing 6 months to go through now because this thing is in a very long looping orbit from a low point of 250 miles to a high point of something like 27,000 miles. It's going around Mars once every 35 hours. What they want to do is to shrink that orbit down so that it eventually is a two-hour orbit at roughly 180 miles altitude. And to do that, they have to dip the low point of the orbit deliberately into the atmosphere of Mars 500 times, George, in the next 6 months in a maneuver called aerobraking, where they literally use the friction of the air on the solar panels in the body of the spacecraft to slow it down a bit and shrink that orbit. And that is a real nightmare, because Mars orbital atmospheric properties are constantly changing. The density is changing, and it's like if you dip too deeply in, you'll crash and burn. So this is not over. This is just the beginning of a six-month nail-biting situation.
Well, and they were tense today before this probe went into orbit. Why, Richard?
Well, because back in 1992, you may remember that we had a spacecraft called Mars Observer that went through a procedure where it pressurized the fuel tanks and it was going to, you know, get ready to turn on the engines, and it disappeared. And they surmised, the after-action analysis, you know, months later, surmised, they had no telemetry, so this was all done by basically computer projection, but they surmised that when they opened up the valves to this very incendiary fuel, it's called a hypergolic fuel, where if you mix two drops together, it explodes. They thought they might have had a fuel leak in one of those valves, because the spacecraft was actually a kind of a cobbled together thing borrowed from the Pentagon. It wasn't really intended to spend 1,000 times more time in space going to Mars. It was supposed to be a geosynchronous satellite bus for Earth orbit. And to save money, NASA tried to use one spacecraft design for another spacecraft design, and it apparently didn't work. So when they opened those valves before the rocket burned, they surmised, again, it's all computer projection, that the thing blew up. So today, at about 10 minutes of the hour, I was sitting here looking at the screen, looking at my watch, looking at the clocks, and I was listening to them count down the seconds to those valves opening to pressurize the fuel system, because that could have been bluey, the whole mission gone right there. And fortunately, everything worked, because MRO is an interplanetary spacecraft designed from the ground up.
What are we going to be able to do to help you get some of the cameras of the MRO pointed towards Cydonia?
What we want people to do tonight is go to the Enterprise Mission main page. We have a very, very nice story there called Forbidden Planet Mars, which may give you a hint as to what I'm going to be talking about. We have some background on the spacecraft. We have background on the resolution of the cameras. We have some stunning new evidence, new political evidence, that NASA has known for over 50 years, George, of what is on Mars. And in part two, which I will post next week, you and I will discuss what this audience can do to get the photographs, 12-inch resolution photographs of these artificial objects on Mars, to finally resolve this issue once and for all.
Those will be exciting times. Richard, thanks for the update on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
My pleasure.
Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. Hey, a new high-resolution digital image of what has become known as the Ararat Anomaly is reigniting interest in the hunt for Noah's Ark. The location of the anomaly on the northwest corner of Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey has been under investigation from afar by ark hunters for years, but it has remained unexplored, with the government of Turkey not granting any scientific expedition permission to explore on site. But the detail revealed by the new photo from Digital Globe's Quick Bird satellite, which you can see as the feature article on coasttocoastam.com right now, has a man at the helm of the probe very excited once again about all of this. We will talk to that man in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Parsha Taylor is a West Point graduate professor at the University of Richmond. He is an attorney and a law professor who has strongly advocated to the U.S. intelligence community for 9 years that a full declassification of the anomaly file in the area of Mount Ararat would be a major victory for Turkish tourism and pride and a public relations bonanza for the CIA. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Portia, I've got to tell you, this is a very interesting photograph that I'm looking at from this high-resolution digital image. Earlier, you know, I've looked at older pictures of Mount Ararat, and I really can't make anything out. This time, you could just about see the bow of what could be a ship. It really is something else.
Indeed, if we were Bob Ballard in 1985 searching for the Titanic in the North Atlantic, if we saw this same image on sonar, on our sonar scanner, we would be intrigued by it. But the problem is this is at 15,300 feet on the northwest corner of the western plateau of Mount Ararat, and boats are simply not supposed to be up on mountains.
What are we going to be able to do to convince, first of all, the Turkish government to let expeditions up there? And what kind of help might an audience of 5 to 10 million people do to help you?
In 1996, I briefed the Turkish military attaché at the Turkish embassy in Washington, D.C., General Salah Setenkaya at the time. He was most intrigued with the aerial imagery that I showed him that I had the Pentagon release in 1995 of the Ararat anomaly, and he said it would be a matter of convincing the president on the civilian side, the Turkish president, that there might be something potentially man-made on Mount Ararat, and if I could accomplish that, he indicated that there would be keen interest on behalf of the Turkish civilian side of the government to direct the military to assist in such an endeavor. And that has been pretty much my mandate all these years, is to get more definitive imagery of the anomaly to hopefully convince a neutral and detached number of scientists and experts and the like that there indeed might be something man-made at this particular site. And the really good news is now with this great Quick Bird satellite shot at 2-foot resolution, within 12 months, three new birds are going up. Three new commercial birds are going up. One, a RadarSat satellite by the Canadian government, which will be much better than the current RadarSat image that I have from the Canadian government. And then also two U.S. commercial satellites will be going up down to the half-meter range, which will be about 18 inches, which will be even better than a Quick Bird image. In fact, one of the satellites is called WorldView, which is going to be the high-tech successor to Quick Bird. So in the coming months, I'm hoping to have all those satellite companies fly, hopefully calibration missions, or calibration missions being testing out their cameras over Mount Ararat.
Why is the Turkish government in the past been so vehement about letting us up there? You know, they've allowed missiles there. They've allowed us to send troops there. They've allowed planes to land on their bases. But why this? Why this, Portia? Why have they been holding back on this one?
The Turks have not so much held back on this. It's really more of a matter that there have been several private individuals and expeditions that have been to Ararat in the last 30, 40 years. Almost all those, by the way, have been on the other side of the mountain, about a mile and a half away on the Hora Gorge side, and not this particular site, which is truly the only unexplored site on Mount Ararat. The Turkish concern is, especially in the last 20 years, that You've got Iran, which is about 19 miles away or so, and then you've got the former Soviet Union, Armenia, about a dozen miles away or so as well. So geostrategically speaking, this has been a very sensitive neighborhood for a number of years. It's basically a restricted military zone in Turkey, and that there were clashes in the past between Turkish soldiers and terrorists in close vicinity to Mount Ararat. So not so much because of the content of Ararat or what might be up on Ararat, be it something of biblical proportions or otherwise. The Turks simply want to, and another dimension is also protection. If there is a priceless biblical artifact on Mount Ararat, then the Turkish government most certainly wants to protect that. Unfortunately, there have been some articles in recent weeks and months about accusations by the Turkish government against a few, I believe, American museums of antiquities theft. In other words, actually, or call it what you want, borrowing from artifacts and the like from Turkey and not returning them. So there's probably going to be litigation over that. So the Turkish government is very sensitive to the issue of a potentially priceless artifact being in its on its territory, and how the world might respond to that, and they certainly want to be extremely conservative and cautious about that.
The digital photograph, Portia, that I'm looking at, we've got it posted on the coasttocoastam.com website, looks like some at least greenery or part of the mountain that the snow has melted away. Am I looking at that correctly?
Indeed. What's really most interesting about this image, this is the first time ever that an authentically nautical type of form, structure, if you will, has ever been seen on Mount Ararat, and especially given the magnitude and the size that we're talking about. This has got striking symmetry of a ship-like structure, of a Titanic-like structure for 1,015 feet. This is at least 1,015 feet long. The next, which, by the way, would dwarf the Titanic and the Bismarck and would be equal in size to our largest aircraft carriers today. The width is difficult to determine because whatever it is, rock or potentially man-made, it appears to be listing. It appears to be at an angle. It doesn't appear to be standing up. So therefore, it's difficult to tell the width, but it looks to be about 160 feet wide. Now, each pixel in a 2-foot commercial resolution satellite is 2 feet in length. So this is a precise measurement, 1,015 feet in length, by one of my team members, Rod Franz, who's a retired Air Force intelligence imagery analyst. And he precisely measured that using specialized software that's used not only for CIA reconnaissance satellites, but also for commercial satellites. Now, the potential significance of something being 1,015 feet long on Mount Ararat and about 160 feet wide is this. We have a 6-to-1 length-to-width ratio given from the Genesis blueprint, and that is 300 cubits to 50 cubits. Now, in my research, cubits have really not been relevant as far as size because, quite frankly, no one knows exactly what the length of a cubit was in ancient time. Now, almost all biblical scholars pretty much think it was 18 inches. Some think that a cubit, a royal Egyptian cubit, I believe, is about 2 feet, but even that's not exactly precise.
Right.
Here, we are arguably looking at something, if it potentially is man-made, and I'll be happy to talk about my private discussions with the intelligence community about
sure.
that in a moment, but we're looking at something that is in the ballpark of the Genesis blueprint. And one thing that's intriguing to me about the Genesis blueprint of 6-to-1 length-to-width ratio and 3 decks and 1 door and the like as far as the description given, there's really not any translation issues there. Those are numbers. There's certainly, some could argue there's ambiguity in the Genesis record as far as the Noah flood about the mountains of Ararat, for example. There's only 2 mountains called Ararat today, Big Ararat and Little Ararat, and we're looking at Bigger Ararat here with a quick bird shot. But with respect to the mathematics, the 6-to-1 ratio, that's really straight numbers. It's unambiguous, is my point. Now, there is a satellite, there is a software company that has the only algorithm in the world that can take, you'll notice a big shadow that ridge line, if it is a ridge line, or potentially man-made structure, is casting off the mountain. The question is, what's the height of this? There is a software company. It's a defense contract intelligence community software company that can actually use an algorithm and take the shadow cast by anything, whether it's the Empire State Building, whether it's the anomaly on Mount Ararat, and give you the exact elevation of that structure that's casting the shadow. I've been talking to that particular company.
All right, let's talk about them when we come back, Portia. Plus, I want to get your take on what some of these private discussions have been with the intelligence community. Then a little bit later on this hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with our special guest this hour, Portia Taylor, as we investigate the possibility of Noah's Ark up there on Mount Ararat. I'll be back in a moment. And our guest this hour, Portia Taylor, as we're talking about Noah's Ark. Portia, let's talk a little bit about this company doing this specialized digital photography, and then let's chat about the intelligence community as well.
Digital Globe owns and operates the world's first 2-foot commercial resolution satellite, that being QuickBird, which was launched about a month after 9-1-1. It's done spectacular service for the CIA and the entire intelligence community as far as Afghanistan and Iraq. It also has many corporate clients around the world, and I feel very fortunate and privileged to have them fly several missions for me gratis over Mount Ararat in 2003. Because there's such thick cloud cover over the anomaly, in particular on Mount Ararat, they had to fly about 3 or 4 missions, and then finally on February 1st, 2003, the cloud cover broke, and we have a most intriguing image of Mount Ararat, of the Mount Ararat anomaly, which you have before you, showing a very distinct and symmetrical ship-like, Titanic-like structure partially submerged in the glacier at 15,300 feet on the northwest corner of the western plateau of Mount Ararat. This being, by the way, the only truly unexplored site on Mount Ararat. And most importantly, this is the intelligence community's anomaly site, and it has been since June 17, 1949, when a B-29 bomber, then flying on a classified mission parallel to Mount Ararat, first captured the anomaly on film.
Has it been receding at all from snow and ice since 49?
That's a great question, George. In 1999, Iconos 1-meter resolution satellite flew Ararat. And then later that summer in 2000, flew several more missions, and now we have this QuickBird shot. It's really interesting. There's a tremendous amount of snow cover in some of the images. It really depends on the time of year. This is wintertime, by the way. This is February 2003, the image that you have before you on your website. There's a good amount of snow and ice on this, but notwithstanding that, one thing that strikes me about this image, that it is so salient, so distinctive, that we're still seeing the form of it coming up, if you will, through the ice and the snow. Now, as far as options as to what this might be, the radar sat imagery, which is not optical, which is firing radar beams against the mountain and bouncing back solid structures, confirms that the Ararat anomaly is not really the effect of shadow and the like, that it is a solid something. It is a solid, some kind of structure. So the only real options for this, it would seem, would be it's a huge rock formation, mm-hmm. shaped very much like the Titanic, but much bigger. or it could be something much more interesting, something potentially of biblical proportions. And as I said earlier, at 1,015 feet long, precisely measured, and then as far as a width, it's hard to tell because it looks like it's listing or canting at an angle. It's roughly 160 feet wide, which puts it in a 6-to-1, 300 cubit to 50 cubit, right out of the Genesis blueprint dimensions.
How high up is this on Mount Ararat?
Mount Ararat summit is 17,000 feet. This is at 15,300 300 feet.
It's a lot of water if that's the Ark. Wow. I guess the flood really was real then.
Oh, my God. I had a nautical archaeologist at the London Maritime Museum. I chatted with him on the phone about 12 years ago and telling him that I was in pursuit of getting the intelligence community to declassify satellite imagery of a very distinct anomaly on Mount Ararat. And he asked me, how high up is the anomaly? And I said, well, it's 15,300 feet. And he went, well, gee whiz. He said, I must tell you, Portia, I'm a big skeptic as far as any possibility of a global flood, but I must admit to you that if there isn't a structure, a ship-shaped structure at that level on that Ararat, that was a pretty big flood.
Absolutely. What are they saying to you, the intelligence community, in these private discussions? What's happening here?
First, let me say that I salute the intelligence community for the last 13 years, my involvement with them, because I've been met everywhere with professionalism and courtesy on a very sensitive matter. And why is it sensitive with the intelligence community? And I've dealt with very, very senior Pentagon and CIA officials on this, some, by the way, who I personally know, as well as mid-level officials. And the two understandable concerns are, first, from a national security standpoint, especially in a post-911 world that we live in, a war on terrorism world, that it's really not appropriate either for the public or for enemies in the United States to comprehend or realize just how well CIA reconnaissance satellites can actually discern or see from outer space.
I see. Okay.
That there's been all kinds of speculation out there over the years, as you can imagine, with the media, as to how well these birds can see. There was an article in Business Week magazine 3 years ago, very nonchalantly, stated that these birds can see quite well, to the tune of reading newspapers from outer space. I don't know if
it could be true
statement.
For sure. Yeah.
Sure, I mean, it's an amazing statement. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that, but assuming for the sake of discussion that if that kind of technology exists, that certainly is something that is quite sensitive and classified on national security grounds. The second concern, understandably, the issue is that even if this might be the remains of something of biblical proportions up on Mount Ararat, the intelligence community has no obligation whatsoever to declassify and release the imagery because, it would have no military value, and second, the intelligence community and the military are not in the business of archaeology. So they could not say, well, we're going to release this and declassify this to neutral and detached, dispassionate scientists on the grounds of archaeological revelation and the like. They really have no obligation to do it. They could do it, but they're not compelled or obligated to do that.
Would an expedition prove beyond a shadow of a doubt whether this is artificial or not?
Indeed, nothing's better than ground truth, actually putting an expedition up on the mountain. My goal from the beginning, George, has been to get to the point using what I call satellite archaeology. That's essentially what my project is, satellite archaeology, to make Mount Ararat transparent to the discerning eyes of the public and also the dispassionate eyes of neutral and detached scientists, to get to the point where, geez, someone looks at the satellite image and says, this really could be potentially something man-made. Let's go take a closer look. That's really, simplistically speaking, the initial goal and phase of my project. And with the Turkish government hopefully leading the way, that a team could get up on Mount Ararat, close up and examine this and determine whether or not it's a strange rock formation or something potentially much more interesting. And I would say that one of the key things that they would look at would be obviously whether or not this anomaly, this structure, this potential nautical structure might fit or be in the ballpark of the biblical blueprint, which is a 6-to-1 length to width ratio, an elevation 1/10 of the length, 3 decks with compartments, one door and then some kind of window near the top of the structure. And as far as whether or not, some would say fable, some would say truth, but as far as the potentiality of animals being on board some kind of potential structure like this, then thanks to modern DNA technology, I believe in the school on this, that DNA could pretty much determine what kind of animals might
absolutely. And if they get into it and it is indeed Noah's Ark, you're going to see stalls and cages and everything else. And just the fact that it's been under ice for well over 4,000 or 5,000 years, it could be very well preserved. I got to tell you one thing, though, Portia, it was a long trip down for them, wasn't it?
Indeed, at 15,300 feet, if potentially we're looking at some of the biblical proportions, that's a pretty long hike down.
Absolutely. Stay with us. We're going to take some phone calls when we come right back with our guest, Portia Taylor, and your phone calls on Noah's Ark on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Portia Taylor, our guest, and we'll take some phone calls now. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Maxine. I'm calling from Lander, Wyoming.
Hi, Maxine.
Hi. I haven't heard everything that was said tonight, but I was curious. I sent you an email several months ago about a website that showed Noah's Ark as discovered by Ron Wyatt back in the mid-80s.
And we're going to be talking to his people next hour, so stand by
for
that.
I'm sorry. Yes. Okay, because I did want to know the difference. Why do people keep going up to that anomaly
when Turkey seems to be satisfied? We apparently have two different regions. There's two different camps talking about where Noah's Ark might be. But to me, the most exciting part of all of this is maybe one of the two's got to be the Ark. Something's got to be there.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And my heart, at least, was very satisfied that it was the other place, further down, where they didn't have to face 15,000-foot lack of oxygen, but 14 miles down on Mount Ararat, where the valley is called the Valley of the Eight, where there's a lot of history there.
Unfortunately, what you're referring to is nothing more than a rock formation. That's been confirmed by the Turkish government a long time ago, and any tourist or anyone can simply walk there and see that literally, I believe this is at about this 4,000 or 5,000-foot level, about 20 miles off of Mount Ararat. Turkish Air Force in 1960 or so flew over, and a pilot took a photograph of it, and there was initially some excitement in Turkey, but the Turkish government confirmed it was nothing more than a rock. But some Americans went over there and over time convinced the Turks it might be something else. And in the final analysis, I believe I'm in school to say the Turks were not very happy about the final results in that regard. I emphasize again that this is a CIA, this is the intelligence community's anomaly site, which has intrigued them based on high-resolution classified satellite imagery. And I've been off and on knee-deep with several folks in the intelligence community about this for the last 13 years. I've basically got three admissions off the record that based on their satellite imagery that this anomaly, the one that George has before him right now on the website, is the remains of some kind of huge boat or some kind of ship. Quite frankly, anomaly confusion, yes, I'm aware that there are other researchers who've been making claims for years about various sites near or around Mount Ararat. I'm not discounting the possibility that anything could be at those other sites, but in the case of the one you just mentioned, if you're talking about the same one I'm thinking about, that's nothing more than a rock formation. And I, quite frankly, have never understood all the interest and excitement about it.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, Portia, even if it is the rock formation, in all likelihood might be, it has that ship shape to it as well as the CIA photograph. I mean, there's something weird about all these photographs.
I hear you, and that's an interesting point. But the thing about this well, the anomaly that I'm referring to right now, the CIA has never seen anything at the other site that Maxine is talking about. And also, keep in mind, I've got satellite imagery of all the IRAD area. These missions are all of the IRAD area, zooming in on the anomaly itself, obviously. And I've never seen any evidence at 2 foot resolution, mind you, the quick bird shot of anything else on Mount Ararat that would fall into a large anomaly category. And what I mean by large is something that we're looking at now at 1,000 feet long.
What do you think the depth of the snow and ice might be if it is the arc? And of course, this snow and ice is on top of it and on the side of it. How thick is this?
The ice cap, the permanent ice cap, George, on Mount Ararat is about 17 square miles, by the way, very large, from about 14,000 feet to 17,000 feet under permanent ice and snow, 300 feet. The deepest the ice is in that ice cap is up to 300 feet in some places. In the anomaly area in particular, I'm guessing, I'm after looking at over 60 years of aerial imagery and satellite imagery of that exact spot, I'm guessing maybe 10, 15, 20, 25 feet.
All around it, just in casing it, right?
Yes, but keep it in mind, it's right on the edge of the plateau, so you've got high winds constantly blowing snow off and the like. So it's really going to depend on if it's summertime, you're going to have potentially major glaciation. If it's wintertime, you're going to have more more ice and snow.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I was wondering about maybe the geological aspects of if all the ice on the entire planet were melted, would the levels reach that high? And also, from a mechanical standpoint, a ship made of wood the size of the Titanic, is that at all realistic? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Is it realistic? Maybe.
He's quite accurate on the fact that a ship over 400, 500, 600 feet long out of wood would not be nautically sustainable. That is that I've talked to at least one expert over the years that no one knows what gopher wood is, by the way, but that is a very valid critique, and I'm very pleased to report that I've got a top-notch naval architecture team that has come together in the last 2 months analyzing the satellite imagery and also the Genesis blueprint, and they're going to come up with a computer-generated model and a physical model from a naval architecture standpoint, the anomaly, based on all of this, and whether or not they're looking at it from a naval architecture standpoint to determine whether or not a vessel of that size made out of wood could possibly float and not break apart on the water. So that's a very accurate analysis by that.
Porsche, what does your gut tell you? What do you think this is?
My gut tells me that I side with the intelligence community on this as far as the confidential discussions I've had over the years. For almost 60 years, this exact spot has intrigued them. It apparently remains of some kind of a ship, a nautical structure, that they've been happy to discuss this with me off the record. Many of them are unofficially excited about this, put it that way. because if you really look at this, if it's possible to take away the potential religious dimension of this, that the fact that there could be any kind of potentially priceless artifact hidden away on a mountain anywhere in the world of this size, imagine what scientists could learn from this. I'm sorry, go ahead. Naval architects could learn from this is something that...
You've got to look at the religious overtones, and what's so exciting about it is then it gives the book of Genesis not belief in faith, but belief in evidence. And that's going to be one of the first times you've really had concrete evidence like that to back up the book of Genesis. And that's an incredible story, Porsche.
Oh, it would be. Most certainly, George, it would be a very intriguing story.
I want to keep in touch with you on this story. I have a feeling it is not going to go away. So if you hear anything, you give us a call, okay?
I most certainly will, and I appreciate the time tonight.
Absolutely. Now what we'll do when we come right back, we'll get another side from a group that believes it has found Noah's Ark. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.